In the annals of time, riding social forces as they crest and crash under the shores of history, some would-be heroes stumble but manage to recover their breath. Others are reduced to the flotsam and jetsam of nostalgia. These others are our subjects. They are the vanquished. The vanquished. Vanquished.
Dallas, Texas, November 2nd, 1992. At the Reunion Arena, independent presidential candidate H. Ross Perot speaks before row after row of empty chairs, telling his supporters and the world that his campaign is on track to win all 50 states. The arena's capacity is 19,000. But with no buses chartered to bring supporters to the Election Eve rally, Perot is left with a mere 4,000 cheering fans. "I found the theme song for our campaign," Ross tells them. He gestures to a Dixieland band he's hired that starts to play Patsy Cline's version of the song Crazy. Welcome to The Vanquished. Anders Lee here. Today we are taking on the most successful independent presidential candidate in modern American history, a man by the name of H. Ross Perot. To explore this populist billionaire, as well as the contradictions of being a populist billionaire, I am joined by in-house economist at Current Affairs Magazine, as well as author and professor Rob Larson. I'm now joined by economist slash professor of economics, Rob Larson. Rob, thank you for joining The Vanquished.
Good evening. My pleasure.
Which do you prefer, economist or professor? Because I asked you, are you an economist? You said I'm a professor of economics.
Yeah, I would rather be called professor than economist because people technically respect professors. So,
yeah, well, you're in an interesting field with I always hear whenever it's an argument that I hate, the justification is usually, well, 99% of economists agree with whatever the shitty opinion is. And I take it you are, in this sense, part of the 1%.
For once, I'm in the 1%. Yeah, this is my only chance to get in it. So I'm in A. You're in the 1%. I'm in A 1%.
We all are in some ways. But we wanted to talk today about Ross Perot, Independent and Reform Party candidate for president. Why don't we start? What was your first exposure, if you have an initial first memory, of Mr. Perot?
Well, I'm old. So when I was a kid, Perot was something that the adults were discussing. And I remember, the general, because it's such a castrated neoliberal political landscape in the 1990s, when a much younger Rob Larson was in school. And just that there was a third candidate on ballots in different states in those early 90s races was something that people were talking about a lot. But I don't think it was until way years later that I actually looked into what that was all about. But it's your typical third party, partially outflanking right wing Democrats on the left, partly outflanking right wing Republicans on the right. Kind of classic case.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember my first Perot memory. I think it was probably, I remember watching the movie The War Room about Clinton, and he comes up a little bit. It's about the 92 Clinton campaign.
And of course.
Yeah, I mostly remember the line where James Carville says it was the most expensive act of masturbation in political history. His 92 run.
That's great. I hope James Carville falls into a threshing machine of some type and gets made into a sweater or something actually useful to people. Perot campaign. I mean, I don't know. All these things, these political figures, they're all, vain idiots who Google their own name and touch themselves. I assume That was never proven, but I'm taking a wild guess. So you're looking at a guy who comes out of business and, you know, has some pet issues. But it seems like the thing he's mainly remembered for was his position on like NAFTA and outsourcing, which was a big deal at that time, as I recall hearing. So, I mean, that's kind of what I mainly am sort of knowledgeable about. I think my first, now you make me think about it, though, I think the first time I ever heard of him, I believe it was a Mad Magazine satirical depiction of the 92 election. And he was, as far as I can remember from 30 years ago, I think he was mainly depicted as someone who was wishy-washy because he was in the campaign and then withdrew and then went back into it. Mm-hmm. And the comedy writers were pretty focused more on that than on the like POW issue or NAFTA or anything like that. So as always, I'm not sure, I don't know if the comedians had the best satirical angle on him.
Yeah, I know Amanda Bynes, before she, you know, went out to lunch, was I think she did an impression of him on All That, if I'm not mistaken, but I didn't have cable.
It's all more than he deserved.
Well, he is a fascinating figure in many ways. He was a billionaire, developed electronic data systems back when computers were still kind of a new thing. It was like a giant thing you had at the back of the office and like luxurious offices, I guess. And then he, in the late 70s is really when he became a national figure over the Iran hostage crisis, because some of his employees were hostages. And he hired some people to help them. And the details of that, little fuzzy, though he definitely took advantage of the situation by commissioning a writer to write a book about it and then making it into an NBC docudrama that involves a commando raid, which didn't actually happen.
Yes. Say it did not end that way in reality, of course. Yes.
Right. But he was very skilled at cultivating his image in the 80s. He had a big falling out with the Republican Party over the POW issue, which is something that's comes up on the show quite a bit. But there was a conspiracy theory in the late 80s, early 90s, that there were all these POWs in Vietnam. He was very adamant. And one of these guys who you see a lot in politics who doesn't serve in the military. I mean, he was in the Navy, but he missed Vietnam. And as a result, I think became like really obsessed with the troops, this concept of the troops, maybe from his own military service, but was just so adamant that we still had guys over there and that the Reagan administration wasn't taking it seriously. So that's where I think his beef really started with H.W. Bush.
So it's
yeah. I did want to ask though about I'm reminded of, there's a quote from Juan Gonzalez that's often applied to Trump, where he says that he is the country's largest small businessman. So somebody who massive, you know, amount of money and pro cashed out from, selling to GM, his computer company, but is still concerned with a lot of these sort of small capitalist issues, namely trade and deficits. What is that phenomenon about? I guess the petite capitalist versus the globalist order.
Oh, that's interesting, you know, and there's a lot of dimensions to that. But, just broadly speaking, like the tendency is for small business people to be seen as being more focused on, you know, what people could call their parochial interests, more interested.
Parochial? Like,
yeah, so they're issues unique to their own industry, whereas often big national multinational firms at least have a reputation for being more like global in their view, in terms of we want policies that benefit all large businesses, not just my sector. It's like that's a reputation, of course. And, you know, broadly, though, like that is kind of the big distinction there is like your larger firms, your big business, you deal with big national markets, international markets. You know, you think in a global decision making landscape frequently. Smaller businesses, like at least historically, have a tendency to be more nationalist and to form the constituency for fascist political parties and stuff like that.
Right. And I guess maybe we do owe Perot some credit for not going full on fascist, because he was at least a moderate on a lot of social issues. And when people say he was the original Trump, I guess in some ways that's true. Businessman, celebrity, no political experience. However, he was not particularly, at least outwardly, xenophobic or socially reactionary.
Yeah, like his passionate connection with the base was not based on dirty Mexicans. It was based on, did we leave behind three Americans while we burned down a million foreigners in Vietnam? Did a single American, you know, finger bone get left behind while we killed 4 million Cambodians and Vietnamese? That is like, that was the live wire that he's considered to have tapped into the Republican base on. And as you said, yeah, drove a lot of his split with the main conservative establishment, especially H.W. Bush, of course. So like that I would see as like the major distinction, but also like Perot was at pains to like stay within, like, you know, he ran an independent run and so on, but he was happy to like work within the political party system. And, you know, for all his criticisms of business and politics, like he stayed within like the system. He wasn't as much of a wrecker of the institutions the way Trump is. On the other hand, you know, Trump has never like had an organized plan in his life. So it's also completely ad hoc. And of course, we don't have visibility into what a Perot administration would have been like. But just going on the campaigns, I mean, there's enough there that he could have won if he'd stayed in the race. Like, it was looking pretty good for him for a minute there before he changed his mind and then changed his mind.
Right. Yeah, that's an important part to this. I think he is similar to Trump in that a lot of this stuff, I think, seems very extemporaneous. Like, he's kind of winging it in a lot of ways. He likes the attention, doesn't necessarily always know what to do with it. But some of his national political involvement gets started around 1991, where he speaks at this convention called Throw the Hypocritical Rascals Out, was the acronym. I guess they couldn't come up with a W for the TH. They just did THRO. Throw them out wisely, I guess, would have worked. But that makes him kind of the face of independent politics in America. Declares he's neither a Democrat nor a Republican. And then in early 1992, Larry King, who was, you know, that was like Twitter in the early 90s, was people going on Larry King. That was like, yeah, where trending events were reflected.
With young, dynamic TV host Larry King. This was 600 years ago, we should clarify.
It is strange how he became that guy. And also somebody who really winged it a lot of the time. And I say that as a former, we're on the same network briefly, but he, Ross Perot asks him again and again and again, are you going to run for president? Are you going to run for president? And eventually, and this is a key part of it, he says he will if volunteers get him on the ballot. And that first like couple of months there, that I was looking back, there's never really an official like announcement, like I'm doing it. He's kind of saying like, if I'm wanted, if you meet the standard, then I will do it, but I'm not going to announce before that. So it's this weird sort of purgatory where he's doing all these campaign appearances and interviews and things, but he's saying, I'm not yet a candidate.
Yeah, but like earnestly not declaring, at least based on, you know, how I've read the material on it. Yeah, like earnestly, like, well, I don't know, should I? I mean, if people want to work hard for me and do the pain in the ass work of getting ballot access in 50 stupid states where it's very difficult to get in and the parties basically control the ballot lines, you could see how he'd be like, look, if you guys do a magic amount of work and achieve an impossible result, then yes, I will. Like, I think he was earnestly kind of saying, I doubt it. If you guys do all this magic work, I mean, sure, then I will. Little did he recognize, of course. But it's funny, too. It just shows that, like, if you, like, have something that appeals to people, even if you go, like, I don't know, I don't think I want to, presidency is stupid, I guess if you guys do all the work, maybe I'll walk in and do it. That can work better than being Ron DeSantis and like I'm going to do an amazing launch on the most cutting edge platform ever and immediately shits the bed and it crashes and everyone hears, is this on? And then we come back and it's 20 minutes of kissing Elon Musk's ass. You know, you do better with a, again, it's like anything in life, you know, people want you if you don't want them. You know, if you're actually like, no, I don't really don't want to, it's stupid. People are like, oh, maybe we should get him though. You know, it's like auditioning. If you don't audition, people are like, yeah, but he could be really good. If you audition, you know, you show exactly what you are. And the same is true here. Like, he could be like exactly what we need. And it's amazing to think what could have happened. I mean, he was polling quite well when he first decided to drop out there, which again speaks to how he actually seems to have been ambivalent about the campaign.
Right.
Gotten in, I mean, we wouldn't have had the Clinton administration, which would have put us on a completely different historical path, from NATO expansion to NAFTA to gun laws to deregulating the banks. Almost every fallout of the 21st century is because of the Clinton administration, other than 9/11, obviously. So, you know, it's a hell of a counterfactual if he hadn't had feet of clay.
Yeah. Yeah. And as you mentioned, he's leading in May of 1992 with 34%. Bush has 28%. Huh? Yeah. Clinton's at 24%.
He took it out of the Southern, two Southerners, you know. You
can see. And they're all kind of from the same region, right? Well, I mean, Bush is originally from Connecticut, but he's living in Texas. Clinton's from Arkansas, and Perot is literally from
Plano, Texas, I think. Or maybe that's where his company was based. Plano was involved.
He grew up in Texarkana, so he's literally between...
Older child. Wow, that is close to Clinton. Oh, you're right, the Arkansas. Yeah. Huh? Fascinating.
But he's running a sort of an interesting hybrid campaign in terms of the issues. He's anti-corruption. He only accepts $5 donations for a time. And because of Buckley v. Vallejo, though, he's allowed to fund it himself, the lion's share. But he's not influenced by the lobbyists and the big donors.
Interesting. Like the other candidates. That goes a long way, as we discovered in 2016. That's
right.
That is really-
yeah. But his main, one of his main issues anyway, is the deficit, which he calls that crazy aunt in the basement. Everyone knows she's there, but no one talks about her. And it kind of seems like he puts deficit spending and more so the national debt on the national agenda. Yeah. Because they weren't really, you know, Reagan was a huge deficit spender. It feels like, I mean, I wasn't alive in the 80s, but it seems like it didn't come up as much until Perot. He kind of changes the conversation and introduces this concept to a lot of Americans that, like, well, the economy's bad. My economic life is bad. I owe a lot of money. I'm in debt. The government's in debt. It must be like the same thing, right?
Yeah, and this does get back to the issue raised earlier about like small business versus like the landscape of big business. Like large firms, especially ones that like do a lot of international business or business with the federal government, they recognize like the federal deficit and the national debt is not quite like your personal mortgage or a credit card debt. I mean, you know, you don't get to print your own currency. The United States does. The global currency system of the global currency of the world economic system is the U.S. dollar, gives us a large amount of leeway on running trade deficits that would beat the shit out of the currency of any other country doing that. But it's interesting. Yeah, Perot said, like, she's like the crazy aunt in the basement. No one ever talks about her. All conservatives ever do is go on about the deficit. Shut them up about the deficit. That's the, I would say now the deficit, it is crazy aunts that won't shut up about the deficit and those Democrats and their spending. Whereas, of course, the deficit is mainly a creature of the Reagan-Bush-Trump tax cuts, which fairly deeply sliced away at the tax base of the United States right at a time that incomes were stagnating or declining for the majority, just guaranteeing that federal receipts were going to fall well short of spending, even before we look at all the bullshit spending that exists from, you know, several $10 billion a year on fossil fuel subsidies to actively encourage the destruction of the earth. You know, back then it was, you know, a mere $500 billion military budgets. It's nothing. Plenty of outrageous things that conservatives love to spend on, but, you know, the easy caricature is, oh, Democrats are all giving this money to black families, your money. Like, that has become the conservative sort of face of it. So maybe, you know, maybe Perot is right. Like, that's back when we were just starting to run up the deficit so we could have something to use as a cudgel for getting rid of Medicaid, which, of course, is the main goal of all of this. So, yeah, he may have been the pioneer on that. But at the same time, you know, Clinton, his whole second term was deficits bad, cut the deficit. And that's the last time we ever had a budget surplus, of course, was 98, 99, 2000 fiscal years, the last 3 years under Clinton. Big deficit, you know, big spending cuts, mainly on welfare and other discretionary items like that, infrastructure. And as I recall, he rolled back part of one of Reagan's cuts, which, of course, then Bush took care of later. But yeah, Perot's probably a pioneer on at least that deficit issue being a national animating factor.
Yeah. And similar to Clinton, he wants to cut spending to eliminate the deficit, but he also is willing to raise taxes. So he's just like a hardcore. Yeah.
What?
Yeah. He says that, you know, if that's what it takes to eliminate the deficit and then later the debt, we gotta raise taxes. But he wanted to allow for an electronic plebiscite that would just have everybody in America vote on whether or not their taxes should go up to eliminate the debt.
I kind of forgot about that national referenda system he was interested in. That's actually, I think, the best idea he had. I like that more than anything else, was actually voting on, like, you know, specific policy items. That's, no one's brought that up since then on such a serious scale.
Right. It's a good idea. And it's kind of strange. Like, we're one of the only countries I can think of that, you know, we vote for two offices of president, vice president as a country, and we don't really vote anything else in on a national basis. But I'm curious, as an economist, this idea that is floated sometimes, that I believe Perot at least flirted with, of zero debt beyond the deficit. You know, that's the annual budget for shortfall. The cumulative amount of money the country, quote unquote, owes as the debt. What would actually happen to the economy if that was eliminated?
It means the next time we have a recession, we're never getting out of it, or it'll take 10 years. That's how we manage the business cycle now, is what macroeconomists and Keynesian economists like to say, is you do counter-cyclical budgeting. So when market economies, you know, they usually grow in their volume of production over time, economic growth, but they go through these reliable but unpredictably timed periods of shrinking instead that we call recessions. And until the 1930s, we would just have recessions and they would just beat the shit out of us for 10 years. And often people would call them depressions because they would go on forever. Like, most of the 1890s was in recession. Back at that time, it was called the Great Depression. No one remembers that. And you have like panics in 1907 and some others. And then the one we remember is the Great Depression in the 30s. And we got out of that through the gigantic fiscal stimulus of World War II, where now all these shut down depression era factories that have been closed for, or, you know, I've been going through the Depression, which went on for 10 years, not an exaggeration, 1929 and 1939, September of both years, with the, you know, the stock market crash in September of 29, and then the Nazi invasion of Poland in September of 39. Like, those are the bookends for the Depression, because that was what kicked off the huge fiscal expansion. You can't have a giant wartime drive to build tanks, bombers, and battleships if you can only spend money that's already come in on tax receipts. And you're going to have to do a giant tax wave to pay for this stuff that would have kept us in recession. So you do deficit spending. And that was kind of the big lesson that economists consider themselves to have learned, at least economists who would today be considered more liberal, like Paul Krugman's kind of a famous one. There's lots of like academics are in that vein, like, you know, Joe Stiglitz and others. And they make the case that you want the government to have the ability to have at least some debt and run some level of deficit, because you can be counter-cyclical with it. So when the recession comes, you can cut taxes and increase spending. And those things, you know, increase people's money to spend. They spend money. Companies have demand for goods. They hire workers. Workers have their own money. Next thing you know, you get out of the Depression. On the other hand, when you have like high economic growth and there's like a market bubble forming in assets, which happens a lot these days, thanks to Clinton deregulating the financial markets, or maybe you have a you know, high inflation wave, which used to happen back in the old days and happened last year and stunned everybody because it's been so long, then you can run a budget surplus instead, which pulls sort of demand out of the economy, increasing taxes, cutting spending. Those things are recessionary in their impact on the macro economy. And I, you know, I would say there's everything wrong with how we run our economic policy. Not a single part of it is run properly. But one thing you don't want to do is take away the government's ability to do any kind of fiscal policy, because that means next time we have some big fat recession or just any emergency, like Nazis conquering Europe or the coronavirus killing a million Americans, you want the government to have an emergency ability to spend more than it has right now and sell some fucking bonds to pay for that. Excuse me for saying fuck. No economist ever swears. And so you could say, like, a lot of people are like, well, that sounds nice, mandatory balanced budgets or a very tiny cap on the national debt. Sounds great until you look at like what capitalism does, which is it's prone to irregular bubbles and crashes and long depressions unless somebody big enough to get us out of the depression stimulates demand. And there is no entity capable of doing that other than the national government, much to every conservative's chagrin. So the answer, that's a long answer. The short answer is, if we go with this Perot balanced budget amendment, it means we will be castrating fiscal policy, and you will not have any means of stimulating the economy out of the recession, if you think that's good, or just dealing with emergencies like big wars. Everyone, if you ever want to shut up a conservative about that, just say, like, how are we going to pay for the next war? You want a deficit? And they're like, well, yes, that's an emergency. China's evil. Of course, we have to have war there. So you can kind of crack conservatives with that little thin edge of the deficit spending argument. But that would be the downside of Perot's thing. And this was, of course, before giant deficits became the norm. This was after only one administration of tax cuts on the rich. Reagan did, you know, that really large 84 tax cut, but then Bush did too, and Trump's 2017 cut on corporate America, which is mostly owned by the rich households. Like, those things together put us in this condition where we literally will have a $1 trillion deficit this fiscal year, which is totally fucking bananas. But we're not using it to stimulate the economy. It just pays for subsidies to ExxonMobil and giant military spending for Lockheed Martin to get missiles to blow up Russians and Ukrainians with. It's and now Gazans, obviously. So we're doing a deficit now, but it's one that doesn't stimulate the economy. It's one that just puts money directly in the pockets of various of our heinous corporate empires.
Right. So yeah, his fiscal policy is maybe not a left-wing one. However, there's a few of his political reform policies that I am partial to. Ban on soft money, nothing over $1,000, eliminate the Electoral College, make it so election days on a weekend, and the congressional representation for DC, and, you know, the electronic town hall thing, very like sort of retro 90s idea, but I think that's it's a nice thing to have more democracy in the United States.
But there is a bygone era of that view.
Right. It is sort of weird, though. So he gets a little weird on he's very big on foreign influence, is the foreign lobbyists. He does want to ban lobbying for government officials for 5 years, which is a good idea. But he does throw around like foreign lobbyists quite a bit, and specifically wants to extract $100 billion from the German and Japanese for past military aid.
That's great. You know, that is always good. You know, what you should do if you have a war is drop nuclear weapons on them after they've offered to surrender and then build them. This is how you build bridges. That's what we need, is a bridge builder in the world. You know, very medieval to put you on trial and sentence you to death and then build a family. That's it's good stuff. Yeah. So, you know, like a lot of American politicians and just like a lot of Americans, like a lot of people's political views are just like, it seems like they're produced by a random number generator. Like, people will have like the most like hyper left-wing views one moment and then just like ethnic cleansing demands. Like, there's no consistency among people, is there, girl? So it's,
Robert's talking to his cat.
Yeah, sorry, I should apologize. I've got an animal here. I would never call a human girl. That's offensive. So it's, you know, very much an American figure in that way, with baffling assemblies of views. Big corporate figure, huge critic of corporate management. Like, after GM bought his firm, he had a seat on GM's, General Motors, you know, had a seat on GM's board for years and just slagged them nonstop. And eventually they gave him like a couple hundred million to just like push him off of the board for all the critical remarks he was making. I remember, excuse me, this was back when Japan's auto industry was first rising up, and Honda and especially, and also Toyota, were starting to take real market share away from Detroit. A stunning, how dare we let these evil Japanese, after all they did to us, sell us efficient cars just because people want to buy low cost, high mileage cars. Dirty, betraying us Americans. And he made the point. And so GM was quick, of course, as it does today, to blame labor and say, this is high labor costs. Oh my God, our labor costs. We can't compete with the Japanese because of rotten labor. I blame you, the American worker. And Perot made the point that even then, Honda was building what they call transplants, plants like built here in the U.S. by foreign automakers. There's a ton of these things now. Back then, it was a relatively new phenomenon in the early days of modern globalization. And Perot made the point that when Honda makes cars in the U.S., they're very popular and have the same cost base and the same popularity as Honda's imported cars that it made in Japan. And he made the point that Honda was considering exporting the cars that it made in the U.S. to other markets. Like, that's how efficient they were there. So his point was, it's not the workers that are inefficient, it's GM's shitty management. And he was saying this from a board seat. So eventually they gave him like a couple hundred million green mail, as they call it, like was bribed him to leave the board seat from which he was shitting all over their incompetent managerial bungling.
Yeah, he's definitely not the most restrained person in terms of his statements to about business or politics. But in that, when he's starting to take off in the spring of 92, takes out a full page ad in Daily Variety, tries to get celebrities to jump on the Hollywood Express to save the U.S. He manages to get Christy Alley, Sally Field, Dennis Miller, Richard Crenna,
Joe Don Baker is Mitchell. Mitchell's 30th anniversary of its broadcast was this past Monday. So I just want to put that in. Wow. Like I say, Shelley Long and Kirstie Alley is especially impressive because those are the two female leads on Cheers, the most popular 80s sitcom. And they were seen as having adversarial roles. So they're, again, build the Japanese, but I'll build bridges between catty celebrities.
And he's
a unpredictable guy.
He even manages to get Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, Merle Haggard, and Johnny Cash to all support him. And
the country wing.
Yeah, Willie Nelson says that's probably the only thing we all agree on. So yeah, definitely good at building bridges there. He does try to, you know, lean into the bipartisan theme by hiring dual consultants, Ed Rollins, who was a Reagan guy, and then Robert Jordan, who worked for Jimmy Carter. And, you know, pays them the big bucks, but then ignores basically all of their advice.
That's my kind of gig, though. That's great. You get paid, and then like, I had no, he wouldn't listen, so nothing happened is my fault.
Yeah, yeah, you can't take any of the blame. Yeah, he freaks out at Ed Rollins, who goes on the Sunday shows because that's like what you do. You're the, you know, campaign spokesperson. So he thinks he's supposed to do that. And then he doesn't get permission first. And Perot freaks out about that. He yells at Robert Jordan so much after they have an argument on TV ads. Jordan has a panic attack. And then Ed Rollins walks out during one of the tongue lashings and says, "I won't be treated like one of your bus boys here." So, yeah, willing to spend some money on advice, not willing to take the advice, which proves to be a problem.
Not uncommon at that level of money and authority to hire good advice. And then, like, when they tell you things you don't like, you just ignore them. I'm not doing that. That's not my favorite thing right now. Why would I do that? That's a great move. You could just not hire the advisors in the first place and save the money. Yeah. But again, when you got that level of money, it's sort of an abstract idea at that point.
Yeah, and it's kind of a signal that he's serious about it. But he gets in because at this point he's appealing almost equally between Democrats and Republicans. But he definitely steps on a rake at the NAACP convention in 1992.
Patronizing ass address, yes.
Yeah, he's talking about the 1992 LA riots or uprisings, depending on how you view it. And he says, and there's some dispute as to what he actually says, but he's talking about who gets hurt by the police and by, you know, bad economic times. And he says, "You people," and then the audience starts to make noise at that.
It becomes restive, yes.
Yeah, they're a little skeptical of that phrase. They don't love it so much because it has a history. And he corrects himself to your people, definitely catches some heat after that and really does not like the negative attention that generates. He's not used to being under this level of scrutiny. And on July 16th, I think in large part because of the controversy from the NAACP soundbite, he drops out. He's fired Ed Rollins, sick of the media scrutiny, and he kind of soft endorses Clinton by saying that the Democratic Party has revitalized itself. Also claims that you know, he doesn't want a three-way race to go to the House of Representatives, which is where it would be decided if you actually had like an Electoral College tie, which is yet another reason to eliminate the Electoral College.
Yeah, throw it on the pile.
Yeah. But meantime, he, you know, so he, his volunteers are still active, though. They feel really heartbroken, many of them, but they're still going to stay true to the cause and continue to get ballot access. Meanwhile, he's forming an organization called United We Stand, that has a book that I have and got some of that platform from. And they're continuing. And then so finally in September, he invites Democrats and Republicans to come down to Texas and beg him to endorse them. And they both are kind of like, we're not going to, you know, you're not the king of American politics in the way that you may think. And then eventually he says in October, it's back on. After he gets all these letters from young people, he says there isn't adequate attention to the major issues he feels, even from the Democrats. And there's a lot of speculation that this was just a way to stay out of he didn't like the negative press. And so this was a way to avoid it. And then he was planning to just do this all along, which I think I am sort of partial to, that he, you know, was not expecting the level of scrutiny he got as a major candidate. So he just was going to take a break, basically a vacation, and then come back at the final hour and win the day.
Yeah, interesting. That bit I wouldn't have much insight into. I don't know, though. I mean, as we've seen, like these guys, you know, these people are billionaires. They're used to everyone kissing their ass and doing whatever they want. You know, the moment like some advisor like pushes back, like, what is the meaning of this? Like these guys, you know, they're powerful. They're senior in hierarchies. And so they think they're very powerful alpha males. What they become is the most delicate doilies in the universe, who are like very easily offended and flustered if you say anything contrary. Like that's an interesting argument. I always thought it was ingenuine, you know, prevarication about whether he wanted to stay in the race or not. I always think of, I'm not much of an Elizabeth Warren fan, but one thing I'll give her credit for is when she humiliated Michael Bloomberg during the Democratic debates in 2020. Oh my God, I could kiss her just for that. Like that was, but like people should watch that footage. You know, that's all over YouTube, you know. Like Bloomberg is just like stunned because he's like one of the real mega, you know, tens of billions in his media monopoly, you know, empire. So when those guys like really get told off, especially in a public forum like that, where they can't just go like, well, this is outrageous, I think you're embarrassing, when they can't just like come back or walk out huffily, like they're stunned. Like they look like they've just witnessed time travel because it's been so many years. I always tell my students this, like, remember, anyone this rich, powerful, or famous, any one of those three, soon everyone around you kisses your ass all the time. Because you're Warren Buffett, or you're a senator, or you're Justin Bieber. If you're rich, powerful, or famous, and often those overlap, of course. But if you're any of those things, soon all you ever hear is nonstop ass-kissing sycophancy. You're gonna lose touch with reality. Why wouldn't you lose touch with reality if after it's been 3 years since anyone said you were wrong? What happens to you? What happens is you become Elon Musk and every idea you have is brilliant, no matter how much of a shit the bad idea it is. And like the same is true, I think, for Perot. You're like, these people are going to say rude things about me. Everyone's mad just because I told these blacks the truth. I always thought it was very sincere that he was like, and you know what? Look, I mean, it is an insane, warped, fucked up amount of scrutiny you get when you run for president. You are the person who wants all the power. Like you should be scrutinized to kingdom come, you know? So right. I always took it as being an earnest response just to someone who's used to having everything and always being deferred to, suddenly actually experiencing like real contrary digging and just, you know, the dumb ideas and stuff. And bear in mind, you know, this guy's talking about commercial media too, which are the problem in America. I mean, why do Americans have dumb ideas? Watch 1 hour of TV news and you tell me. So I always took it to be a real response from a privileged person who didn't care for the moderate amount of disprivilege you have to have if you want to have your fingers on the nuclear weapon buttons. But I can see it all being a show, you know, again, he was, you know, very much, you know, accustomed to media and stuff. So I would consider that an open argument.
Yeah, well, I think that makes sense because, I mean, if he did plan it, at least it was, we could say, a bad plan, because when he comes back in October, he's at 7%. So, you know, like he was...
fifth of his previous number. That's,
right.
That's bad.
Yeah, so he has a very limited amount of time to try and get to the front of the pack. He spends $70 million on the campaign, including TV infomercials. That sounds like a lot, you know, when, in terms of the money you and I are used to. But
$70 million, was it?
Well, it's half of what Rollins and Jordan recommended for a campaign of this size. And his tension with the media continues. Mr. Perot says he will not answer any questions that are not directly relevant to the nation's concerns, the campaign says. So that means no questions about his own record. He wants to be exempt from basically the normal questions that a candidate gets. So the media doesn't love that. They don't love that. Yes, you said media as a plural, which is the correct way to say it. And I keep having to remind myself. But he does, Perot gets into the debates. He qualifies, which is a huge boon to the campaign. Squeezes in some good lines there. He's accused of not having any experience. He says, well, you're right. I don't have any experience racking up this debt. As for NAFTA, there will be a giant sucking sound south, which is a...
yeah, the famous bit, yes. The right. Giant sucking sound.
Yeah. Were you... at the age where you watch these debates live, or you just know them in retrospect?
Oh no, I was like going from grade school to junior high at this time. This is okay. I wouldn't, and bear in mind, I wouldn't watch those debates today, so I definitely wouldn't back in that time. But that's interesting though. I just looked up that amount, 70 million. That's about 140 million in today's dollars, which, you know, is pretty modest, at least, you know, by the standards of these campaigns. I like to remind people, Michael Bloomberg, pass up a chance to bash that idiot. He spent in his campaign on all those ads and all that ballot access, $1 billion. Oof. It's like $1 billion in change, like the full largest amount of denomination short of the U.S. budget in the trillions. Like that's just, so compared to that, 140 million, Perot, do you really want it, bro? You know, you got to spend those dollars. Yeah, but those debates, like he's considered, I'm aware that he's considered to have won those debates, which is pretty plausible. Like George W. Bush and Bill Clinton, you know, you could beat them. It's a beatable team, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're also made entertaining. At least the vice presidential debate it becomes quite entertaining because Perot's running mate is a guy by the name of James Stockdale.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that. So you should tell me about that.
Okay, yeah, he was a military veteran, very big on the POW issue, which is, I think, how they first made acquaintance. And there's a famous line at the opening of the debate where he says, "Why am I here?" And it gets a big laugh. And it's usually that line that's quoted as an example of his bad performance, but that line gets a laugh. He then goes on in the rest of his opening statement to draw a blank, has to put his glasses on and look down at his notes, and it's seen as a huge flop. At one point in the debate, he's asked about the environment, and he says, if you purify the water too much, the water lilies die. So he's...
yeah, we really got to remember, too, like failing in that debate is pretty humiliating. So you got to remember that man standing between Dan Quayle and Al mm-hmm. Gore.
That's right.
And if you can't outshine those friggin' wood ducks, that's, you know, that's even more beatable than Clinton Bush. My God. Yeah, you know. I don't know. Every third party candidacy needs a really weirdo on the ticket. That's again why Trump is so disappointing. Just pick boring Mike Pence. Yeah. Again, pick a real weirdo this time, Trump. Come on. I'm sure he will.
Yeah. Well, Perot definitely gets some weirdo points. And I mean this in a good way in himself, because in one of the debates, this is a part that's been kind of overlooked, but I think is really awesome and fascinating in hindsight. He kind of accuses Bush of letting Saddam invade Kuwait for the you know, which triggered the Gulf War. And this has gone on to become more or less confirmed by historians and experts that the Bush administration, they had an ambassador who basically, at a minimum, did not threaten Hussein if he were to invade Kuwait. And Perot at least floats that this is a possibility that the ambassador told Saddam that he could invade Kuwait, which we don't know if that's true or not, but we do know that. Tragic. Yeah. But at a minimum, though, the Bush administration didn't release any documents about it. And, you know, Hussein had released a tape and who said it was a transcript of the meeting where the ambassador, she said, we will not become involved in your border dispute. And in effect, you can take the northern part of the country.
I think we view this as a regional security issue. She implied that it was like below the U.S. level of concern, which, you know, you could argue is a green light. Like, this is a case where you can, this is an instance where you can make a case that the aggressor power, Hussein's Iraq in this case, was sort of goaded or encouraged into it, you know, similar to the Soviets in Afghanistan and the Russians in Ukraine today. I mean, you know, it's their war crime, but we were kind of like, oh, you should totally go in there. It's going to be great. We would never destroy your country when you do it. Like, there's like a, so what we have on the record is very much like, no, we would never go completely ape if you go in there and have a giant national mobilization that will say beats the Vietnam syndrome, which of course is what President Bush later said after the successful annihilation of Iraq and its armed forces during the 1991 Gulf War, which, you know, barely remember now after all of our years of military misadventure since then. But it's true, you know, and that's, you know, after they had spent years with Donald Rumsfeld, you know, as their emissary to Iraq, and Bob Dole going over there and saying, please don't listen to our media criticizing you for gassing the Kurds. We think you're great. But he was definitely in there with the right wing and, of course, global corporate power structures, Hussein. So Perot saying that Bush like encouraged it or greenlighted like that is an exaggeration. But what we have on the record is pretty damning as it is. This is why I hate it when people like stretch the truth, because often what we have is like pretty damning and is the merit of being proven true. That's great. I didn't realize he raised that issue during the debate. That's pretty bold for a mainstream political candidate in the debate.
Yeah, and to his credit, he always, he says, let's just release the instructions. What instructions did she get? Why are you keeping this a secret?
Come on. I just want to clear the air. Yeah.
And Clinton has to quickly say, well, I think, you know, Bush deserves a ton of credit for Operation Desert Storm and Desert Shield, because at that point, it's a bipartisan issue that this was a success and Bush deserves credit. Some have speculated that the reason he did it, and you know, if this is true, set up Hussein for an easy bucket on the U.S.'s part, that this would help his reelection chances. And in 1991, right after this conflict ends in, you know, a matter of days, his approval rating gets pretty high. And so it takes an artist like Bill Clinton to chip away at it, perhaps with Perot's help, which is something we'll get to in a moment. But it's as I said, mostly overlooked, but it does kind of play into this view that Perot is a conspiracy theorist, which is buttressed by a 60 Minutes appearance he makes on October 25th, 1992, where he claims that the reason he drops out in the first place in July is because Republican apparatchiks had tried to infiltrate his daughter's wedding to disseminate a deep fake photo of her having lesbian sex. Now the FBI is asked about this. They quickly say that they investigated and did not find anything. Also comes out that Perot was spying on his own staff with phone taps.
Of course, that's just the ticking of the clock.
He investigates people left and right, and he also has people take loyalty oaths. And so it's looking sort of promising directly after the debates, but this really damages the campaign quite a bit. There's also something that came out later regarding the wedding. It turns out Perot was the one who hired private investigators to look at his potential son-in-law, who was a professor Perot claimed it came out that this guy was a drug dealer, which was not true. And eventually the marriage gets called off. Perot, of course, blames Bush, when really it was him. And, you know, we mentioned the stuff about him being outwardly sort of socially moderate to progressive. Well, in his private life, not so much, because according to the New Republic, he told his friends, "You don't think I'd let my daughter marry a Jew?"
Texas money. Wow, that's some pretty juicy intrigue. I wasn't familiar with all these claims about the wedding and faked lesbian love affairs. That would only help you these days. It's funny. That's back in the era when Clinton was pushing the Defense of Marriage Act, though. It's definitely a different civil rights landscape at that time.
Yeah.
Fascinating, you know, but yeah, voters, you know, everyone likes this juicy shit, but, you know, fundamentally, people just want to hear you're going to make their lives less awful and let them not have to think about politics for a period of time. It makes sense that he was doing better back at the beginning, where he had, like, you know, a real platform, was taken seriously, and had, you know, like an independent platform, especially like the outsourcing thing now. Like, every politician pretends to be against outsourcing, no matter how much they were voting for it, you know, NAFTA and similar things in the 90s, you know, like Joe Biden, for example, was. It's amazing how much everyone claims to have been against that. Like, Perot can actually say that because he was saying it, like, at the beginning, like before it really, like pre-NAFTA, which is for the U.S. at least, definitely the sort of kicking off of the realities of globalization for most Americans.
Right. He goes on in November on Election Day to win with 19%, which is better than 9%, but nowhere near 34%, which he was leading with in May. He wins several counties in Texas, Maine, California, Kansas, Colorado, and also Utah, where he comes in second.
That is part one of my conversation with Rob Larson. To hear the full episode, which includes the rest of my talk with Rob and a bonus discussion with my co-host Freddie G, please subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/thevanquished. That's patreon.com/thevanquished. And please don't forget to leave us a 4-star rating. Thanks.